If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Liz Konecki's Urban Fabric Project involves embroidering maps of different cities and inviting communities to weave their own narratives into the maps. The project aims to change people's perceptions of place and foster a sense of connection to their surroundings. Liz has conducted these participatory mapping projects in various cities around the world, including Barcelona, Manhattan, Bangalore, Fez, and Morocco. The maps serve as a platform for people to share their stories, memories, and opinions about the city. The slow and interactive nature of embroidery allows for conversations and discussions to unfold, leading to a deeper understanding of the place. Liz's work is influenced by the concept of psychogeography, which explores different ways of experiencing and understanding our environment. And through her art, Liz aims to highlight the layers and stories that exist within a place and encourage people to explore and appreciate their surroundings. This is the first part of my needle exchange with Liz, and it's something I've been looking forward to for a long time. The projects that Liz does are so simple and yet so important. It's a great opportunity for people to take notice of their environment, to tell the stories of a place and leave a lasting reminder of where they live and the experiences that they've had there. And it's something that I would encourage any craft group or geographical based group to consider doing in their own format. I've always loved Liz's work. I've loved telling people about it. And every now and again, you see examples of it, whether it's community artwork, community quilts. You know, those kind of embroidered map projects do occur, and it's just wonderful to see because it really encapsulates a moment in time. So in this first part of our needle exchange, we pretty much just talk about all of that, really. We talk about Liz's work, how people understand their sense of place, and just really nerd out on the stuff. It's a really interesting opportunity to explore the environment, and our conversation just goes all around the houses on that. See what I did there. Thanks for listening to the show. I hope you're enjoying the show. Feel free to contact me, hello@needle.exchange, that's needle without an E, and let me know what you're thinking of the show, or if you've got any suggestions, comments, jokes, people that I should be contacting. And I'll be back next week with the second part of the conversation with Liz. So until then, enjoy the show. So what the thing I love about you is I've known of you for over a decade, I want to say, and every time I think, like, when someone wants an idea of what needlework is capable of, I always think about your projects. And I think, I don't know whether it's because, well, I don't know, it's just such a fantastic idea. And I love the way that you invite communities to weave their own narratives. I think any, like, I feel like yours is the kind of project that everybody who cares about where they live should do. And I'm interested to know, I mean, A, I think if people aren't aware of you, hi, Liz, nice to have you here, then it would be good to talk about your work, if you can explain the work that you do, and then I've got a few questions to kind of ping off the back of that. But sure. Yeah, go for it. Tell us about Urban Fabric.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, also, I'm super happy to meet you as well, because I've just been Like anytime I'm interested in looking for new stitching things, I know that you're the place to go. So
cool.
Yeah. I mean, obviously you're the reference, I think. Totally. And so the Urban Fabric, it's a project that I started, I think it was in 2008. Where basically I embroider maps of different places, different cities usually. And then I take the map on an embroidery table out to public spaces. So in the public square, in the street. And I ask people questions and they embroider into the map answers to these questions about how they feel about the city, their memories of the city, places that are positive, places that can be changed. So it's kind of a way of talking about a place that's fun. And I had worked a little bit with participatory mapping before. I'm quite interested in urban planning and all of these things. And I'd kind of used stickers before, et cetera, people to mark a place on a map with a sticker. Yeah. But in reality, that's just way too fast. Like, I love the slowness of embroidery. I love that people have to sit there for a while, figure out how to thread the needle, how to embroider. Maybe they've never done it before. And then that's the time that they can chat with people. And then that's where conversations really get going about what's happened on this certain street corner before, or just like, you know, even people not arguing, but yeah, sometimes they argue too, but having disagreements about, you know, what should be done with a certain place, how can it be improved, things like that. Or maybe even like they start to understand a place in a new way because the person next to them embroidering there is like, wow, this is where I fell in love, you know? And then people are like, oh, I thought it was just as a street corner where people that smells like piss, you know? So really to kind of change people's idea about place and to feel connected to it.
It's so true what you just said there. I hadn't really clocked that after all this time. But yeah, somebody can do a map and can stick a sticker on it, and that's one thing. But the fact that, like you say, they're going to be there, 5 minutes minimum? And that does give you that opportunity. And also, I guess, for people who don't know how to stitch, it makes them vulnerable, which unlocks a whole nother thing as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, some people know how to stitch and they love to show off their, you know, their different stitch works. But most people, I feel like, have never done it, depending on the country, too. Like, it depends if it's men who haven't done it or sometimes women. So it's a little bit of a learning process, too.
And then you've done it, I want to say, like, all over the world as a broad term, but you've done it in lots of places, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I used to be living in Barcelona in a little fishing neighborhood called Barceloneta. So that's where I did the first one. And then I started going all around. I went to Manhattan, went to Bangalore in India, to Fez in Morocco, to Quito in Ecuador, all over, to LA. I was just most recently in March in Morocco again to do it as well. So
I always used to say when I do a presentation, because I always include your work in the presentations that I do, and I'd be like, Liz has done this in Brooklyn and in Barcelona and in Bangalore and maybe places that don't begin with a letter B, but I'm not sure. But
There are a few.
And I mean, so, because obviously, I guess, mapping is a thing that people do, but people, you know, fabric embroidery is always something that people have a familiarity with. And the other thing that intrigues me with this is the different attitudes you must have, because if you just plop up in the middle of a square all of a sudden with an embroidered map, are the responses the same in different places, or how do you manage different expectations?
That's a good question. I mean, I think there's always some curiosity from some people. They're the ones who approach and kind of say, like, what are you doing here? Some people don't even want to look at you because they think maybe you're selling something, so they just walk on by. And yeah, then in different countries, it's a little bit different. Obviously, in some countries, I stick out, I have blonde hair, whatever. So that causes a little bit, maybe more curiosity in some cases. Yeah, and then there are different approaches to public space as well, I guess. Like in Spain, a lot happens outside, a lot happens in the street. And people are also used to talking to people they don't know out in the street. So there's like quite a familiarity. New York as well, actually. I think New Yorkers have this reputation for being kind of mean and rude, but actually they just speak to anyone about anything. They are super talkative and I loved it. So
In New York, would you run the risk of it feeling, I don't know if hipsters are a thing anymore, actually, I haven't really been paying attention, but do you think it would be, there'd be a layer of novelty on it in that kind of way where people would be like, oh, this must be a groovy thing happening?
I suppose so. I don't really know if hipsters exist anymore either. Also, I've been doing this for a while. Maybe it was before the hipsters that I was in New York.
Maybe you started the hipster thing. We did a map of Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah.
It had needlework on it. Some guy with a big beard went, hey, I like the look of that. Couldn't smile. It's being a hipster. Because I've done, like, I did a psychosocial studies degree, which is a blend of psychology and sociology. And so lots of the stuff that you've done, you know, the way we tell the stories about where we live and the mapping out, I think it's always been of real interest to me, because I think we have these narratives. And what I love is, you know, you can have topography, you can have maps that are made that very much show the place. But I just loved that you were allowing this different perspective on it. So are you able, like, can you think of some of the stories that you've been told that really kind of give that different, like you said about the place, probably not the best example, but the one that smells a bit of piss, you know, you're not going to get that on an ordnance survey. And I just wonder if you've got other examples that really stick out as being, you know, exemplars.
Gosh, I mean, yeah, I've heard all kinds of things. You know, I had back in Fez, this was 14 years ago in Morocco, you know, I had a guy talking about how his grandmother was living in the desert in a tribe, and she was kidnapped and then brought to Fez and then became the richest woman in Fez. And
wow.
Just wild things, you know, really wild things. And then also very like humble stories, you know. Also in Fez, it's a place with a lot of artisans. And so you have the people who make the metal teapots. So he was embroidering his little teapot and a little glass of mint tea, right? Because people are marking often places in the map, but then also I often invite them to just do something that is something that they relate to the city, so something that's emblematic for them or to something important to them. So like in Barcelona, the neighborhood I was in, it was, yeah, some of the kids were a little bit tough, you know, and like the first day they were kind of coming up to me like, what is this, you know, haha, and they're like, I'm gonna cut your map. And I was like, no, you're not, you're gonna embroider with me. And they ended up embroidering with me.
Excellent.
All these teenage boys, but what they wanted to embroider was actually like the tags that they are using for graffiti on the walls of the city. So I think everyone has a way in, because everybody wants to tell their story somehow, you know.
Yeah. And then, I mean, when, because that was another question I was going to ask, when you invite people to stitch, as you say, do they stitch icons? Do you let them stitch whatever they want? Do you do like color coding based on the sort of thing that they're going to stitch?
Yeah. So I have a certain amount of questions that I choose ahead of time, usually with people who live there, to talk about issues that are relevant to their city. So there are questions that have that are color-coded and each have a specific symbol. But then around the edges, I just invite people to embroider whatever they want.
Yeah, and I suppose, do you, because as you say, some people will be familiar to it, some people won't. How much tuition do you give people? Or, I mean, do you let them fight it through? Do you let them spend an hour stitching it if they need to?
Yeah, I mean, I'll help as much as they want me to. I end up threading some people's needles for sure, and sometimes even stitch for them. You know, there are people who can't see very well anymore, some elderly people, or people who are handicapped even, you know, who want to participate, but they can't quite reach where they're trying to get, you know. So I'll help out however much people want me to.
And then what, you sit out for what, a couple of days, or do you sit out until you feel the map is done, or?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's dependent on the place. I mean, in Ibiza where I live, I have a map of the island that I just took out for a few years.
Right.
Until 1,001 people had participated.
Wow.
Yeah. But obviously in other places, you know, I couldn't stay for years in Bangalore. So I was there for a month, you know, and I would go out for various days until I felt it was finished. Yeah.
Mm.
But it could be infinite. It could go on forever. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Each map could fill up forever, you know.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's a question of where the cutoff point is, where you choose to present the thing, like where it becomes like passive, I suppose, to active. Are the maps, say with the Bangalore project then, what was the intention of the map?
I mean, with all of the maps, I'm trying to find actually what is common in all of the places. Like, what does everyone want for their city?
Mm.
You know, like, and there are things like everyone wants more green spaces. Everybody wants safe places. But yeah, for example, in Bangalore, I was working with a group of female art students, and they were also focused on the theme of gender in the public space. So we were also asking some questions about that. Where do women feel safe alone? Where do they feel safe with others, etc.
Mm. And then are you capturing the narrative as well somehow when you're doing it? Or do you just take notes, or do you try and remember it? Or
Usually I videotape people talking about the why of what they've marked. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, because I just think, I mean, it's just so, yeah, I just find it endlessly fascinating. Like, I'm interested in infographics. Basically, that's what you're doing there, isn't it? And it's just, near where we live, there's a village called Shavington, and my daughter goes and does ballet lessons there, and they've got a little map from, like, 1985, I think it is. It's largely cross-stitched, but it's still got that thing, you know, where the landmarks are in. It's definitely not the same as the thing that you're doing, which is, like, psychogeography, isn't it? Your, like, kind of layer of thinking. But this, even on itself, you know, some of the places that are on there aren't there anymore, or they've been turned into a pub, whereas it used to be, like, a shop or something like that. And I just love those moments in time that are captured, because they do represent that thing. And in the same way as needlework always provides a historical reference, whether it's the Bayeux tapestry or the Great Tapestry of Scotland, or indeed the Game of Thrones tapestry, different. You know, I love, because there's a real permanence and there's a real long lasting to these things. So again, and I'm just using the Bangalore one because I think that's probably the most, if you like, unlikely probably of the ones you had done, I would say, because, you know, in Ibiza, in the States, in Morocco, there's more, perhaps, I was going to say urbanization. Maybe I'm being a bit prejudiced here or whatever, but, you know, I feel like Bangalore is such an interesting space to have explored and to got under the skin of. What happened to the map at the end?
Yeah, so most of the maps I've done, I still have. And so occasionally I exhibit them somewhere. But to be honest, I would actually love for each of these maps to live in the place. So actually, the last two I've done, I did one in Zurich this summer, and that now lives. It's part of the collection of the place I was working with. And then I was just in Morocco in a small town in March, and I've left the map with a micro museum, they call
right.
it, so that it can actually keep being participated on forever, like indefinitely. And I love that because, as I said, they can be infinite, of course, and I can't be there physically all the time, but people who visit the museum can keep building on it. So I'm really happy about that.
Another question. You stitched the maps in the first place, is that right?
Right.
Can you talk about the process of that?
Usually it's first about finding a map. I often work with Google Maps, but there are some places where Google Maps doesn't really quite tell you the information, such as some of these medinas in Morocco. They're so tightly, it's such an organic tight thing that you can't really see where the streets are. So I've had to work with different hand-drawn maps that exist and then kind of put things together. But so I usually then print these large and trace them onto the fabric. And then I stitch them using either like a running stitch or back stitch. And each one takes maybe about 100 hours. Then I bring it to the place.
So the act of stitching that map gives you your geography of the place, right? You learn the streets, you learn how they're put together. How does that then marry up with when you get there? Because I think it's one thing to look a map and it's another thing to walk through the streets of the place.
For sure. I mean, I still have to walk through the streets. But it's funny, I actually do call the running stitch my walking stitch because, first of all, I'm a slow stitcher anyway. But then I'm actually slowly walking the streets as I stitch them. And in a way, I may not be able to find my way around the city by doing that yet. But in a way, I'm kind of letting that particular pattern of that city kind of soak into my brain and into my hand, right? So, you know, like there are very gridded cities like New York City, like Manhattan, and then the opposite are these organic medinas of Morocco, for example. So each city has its own morphology, of course.
Yeah, and then do you find like that you'll be in a place and you'll be like, huh? And like maybe the layout of it is something that like triggers in the part of the back of your brain because you know you stitched that bit. Does that kind of happen?
Yeah, totally. And sometimes I realize, oh, the map was a bit wrong also, you know, like this is not how it really is.
Yeah, I always get this thing as well because I've moved around a bit. Sometimes I feel sorry because our oldest daughter's going to be 7 on Monday and the house we're in now is the 4th house that she's lived in, and I kind of explain to people that we're not criminals or in the army, it's just the way it's worked out or whatever. But whenever you move to a new place, I always think you sort of start from like, I don't know, almost like where you stand and where you look, and that's how you orient. You don't go which way is north and you orient off of that. But then sometimes when you put these pieces together, I find like sometimes your whole map can kind of shift in your head or suddenly because of like the directions that you take. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we each have, first of all, like a mental map of each place that we've been to or that we haven't been to. And then it our mental map grows as we know a place more, right? This is why I started to do the project, is because I moved from the US to Barcelona. And so me being a foreigner, I'm like, I don't know any of these places. What do any of these places mean to the people who live here? You know, so this was kind of the motivation in the beginning.
And how much then does your sense of a place change once you've mapped it with all these people? Does it change?
I mean, of course, it just comes to life, right? Because at first it's just like a two-dimensional thing, actually. And then every single place takes on a story or takes on this history. And it becomes multidimensional, I guess you could say.
I love it. We went to Florence once and we did a food tour. And that was absolutely fantastic because it was one like another perspective on the town. You know, here are the nice places to find the food and you get that sense of the narrative. But I love that idea that you might go on a street corner and you look over there and go, oh, yeah, I know a guy who proposed to his now, his wife on the corner of that or something. I just wonder whether maybe you should do a selection of tourism guides. Just
people. Telling people's personal stories, it would be funny.
Just a little,
but you mentioned before psychogeography, that that's something I'm really interested in as well. And for those who haven't heard of it, it's like it's this concept that was talked about by the Situationists. Have you heard of them?
I don't. They sound like they should be a band that came out in the 1980s and did a lot with synths.
Maybe they were also that, yeah. But They were in the 60s. They were artists and activists based mostly out of Paris, but like all over Europe. Guy Debord was the kind of the main guy. He wrote a book called The Society of the Spectacle.
Right.
But they were really fascinated in exploring our environment in different ways. Like, for example, they were very inspired by this study that had come out. A guy mapped a girl's movements over a year. And so she went from her home to her school, to her piano teacher's home and back home for an entire year. Like she never left the triangle.
Right.
And they were like, this is just wrong. You know, what we need to do is actually get lost in our places and discover new places in our city and not just get, you know, be in our same routine all the time. So they invented this concept of la dérive, I think dérive in English, maybe, which is kind of like getting lost on purpose.
Okay.
Yeah. And lots of games to like explore streets you've never been on and things like that. So I've been quite influenced by those people.
It makes me think of geocaching. Do you know geocaching?
Yeah, I think that's like a modern version.
Yeah, we went on holiday to the island of Zakynthos, me and my wife, and used it there because people would put caches in places that you would never go to otherwise. But there would be spectacular views or like in. And I think it's that same thing. It's that kind of layer because people go, I live here. And to me, this is worth your attention. And so I'm going to put a cache here so that you can find it.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I'm interested in this as a concept. So what's your take on psychogeography then? What does it mean to you?
I guess it's just about seeing all the different layers of a place. Like it's very easy, even within our own lives, like always take the same routes. And then also to see those same buildings or whatever in the same way and not to think about who has lived there, what's happened. And so I guess my project for me is like one other, you know, it's another way to see behind all of these things.
There's an idea I like where if you go to London, for instance, you can get around London on the tube very efficiently, or you can go on the top deck of a bus and just look at the top half of all the buildings that you don't look at because you spend your time just walking down the middle of the street. It's that kind of idea, isn't it? It's just reappraising the things that you're familiar with.
Yeah. Yeah. Shake it up.
Yeah. I'm also really, I always talk about as well, so I used to be a town councillor as well. And for a while I was the head of the planning committee. It was only like a parish, but we had a few different developments that were built on there. And so I got a bit of an idea about how this kind of works. And I always like desire lines, because like desire lines are the difference between the way someone has intended you to go and the way you end up going, you know? So when like someone's got like two paths that meet like that, but everyone just walks across the middle and wears a bit of grass out, and you're like, that's the way that you should have made it, you know, that kind of layer. To me, I think that's kind of a psychogeography as well, right?
Totally. I'd never heard of the desire lines. Is the one that the people actually walk on the desire line?
Yeah. And you can see them if you realize that they're there, you can sort of see them. Or if you walk across, if you go to a field and it's kind of overgrown, but you want to know the way people go, you can see it because the grass is just a bit flatter.
But
in urban spaces, you see it a lot, like, you know, whether people are parking on verges or just, it's always that thing. It's always like there's a T-junction in some paths, which made sense to the planners, but everyone's just cut the corner, done the short.
Of course.
I wonder whether they're getting lost ideas, you know, because we go with our own flow, right?
Sure. But I mean, I think also, you know, sometimes when we're not in a hurry, we do this naturally too. Like, I'll maybe take a roundabout way, you know, a windy way home, rather than the quickest way, right? And that's where you kind of discover things more.
Yeah, and it's just the slowness of it. It is trying to pull us up and make us just look at the world and appreciate it. I've said this about a million times as well. Then that's what needlework does, isn't it? Because it reframes sometimes an image in a context that you're not used to, but you're familiar with needlework. So like, for instance, Tanya Bukau is an artist who does a lot to do with migrants and refugees and will cross-stitch detailed images of people who would otherwise be a flash on a news program. But because she's cross-stitched them, you go, huh. And it makes you think about the whole thing differently because of the medium of it. And I feel like the same thing would happen with your maps then, because they're fabric and textile. So rather than them just being a map like you are here, the simple fact that you've transformed yours into textiles probably makes people give them more attention.
Sure. I mean, I also use bed sheets, like on purpose, because everybody's familiar with the bed sheet and that, that intimacy of that. Textiles are, they have so much meaning for us, whether we realize it or not, right?
Mm.
I'm obsessed right now with another podcast besides yours.
How dare you?
I know. You probably know it, Haptic and Hugh.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of them, yeah.
Oh, gosh, I'm obsessed. You have to check it out. Her name is Jo Andrews, and she's a weaver. And she's, rather than interviewing kind of textile artists like you, she is looking into the history of textiles and, you know, all over the world and what textiles mean. I mean, it is mind-blowing.
Mm.
Yesterday, I was listening to one, in fact, that needles predate textiles.
Mm.
Because people were sewing their skins.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? So the needles predate swords, they predate textiles. So it's pretty cool, you know, the history of the needle.
I can remember, I think I quoted it when I did a TEDx talk, like they found some needles at a site in Russia and they carbon dated them to being like 30,000 years or something. And you're just like, this is what twists my melon. Like I can distinctly remember I went to the Ashmolean Museum, I don't know, 12 years ago, something like that. And I was looking at like a piece of Chinese needlework from like 750 BC or something, and all of a sudden I went, oh my god, this thing's massive, you know, because it's rare, I think, to be involved in a medium that has got that lifespan and that cultural significance. It's bonkers.
It is, yeah. Mind-blowing.
And how do you feel about being a part of that?
Oh, I love it. I mean, it's a lineage, right? It's a lineage from prehistoric times, let's say.
Mm.
You know, I'm familiar, of course, with my more recent lineage, which is, you know, I learned from my grandmother, as many people did. Many people have. My grandmother worked in a fabric store, which was just like a playground.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, all the yummy fabrics. And she was a quilter. I'm from the U.S., so it's like these American-style patchwork quilts.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they would do them was like a bunch of friends sitting around and working all on one quilt, right? And so I was quite inspired by that as well, even though I never got to see her doing that live.
Right.
But I sort of feel like my project is kind of just the inverse of that, because we're all sitting around one cloth working on it together, but instead of it being your friends, it's a bunch of strangers.
but you're both telling stories, right? Because wasn't there something to do with like the G's Bend quilts and those kind of things? Like there would be tales woven into those quilts somehow, whether it's through pattern formation, that kind of thing. Like they would be able to tell tales.
Sure. I mean, the G's Bend ones are absolutely incredible. I don't know if my grandmother was kind of stitching stories in, but I do know that the kind of chatting with friends was a really important, like, just social moment between women to share stories about their lives. So I guess in an indirect way, that was happening while they were stitching these abstract patterns,
Yeah, they're all kind of community efforts, aren't they? And some are more deliberate, but for each of those people, like presumably your grandma's network of friends would all have a quilt that they'd all made together. So they've all got that, like, legacy from that moment.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.